Argument in Wright versus Moore. Morning, Mr. Aber.
Morning, Your Honor. Before it may please the court, before I begin, I have to apologize to the court. Using the old Army expression, you can delegate authority but not responsibility. There was an error made in the appendix that I filed in the to the plaintiff or defendant's appeal, and that there were two depositions for Dr. Bose, a discovery and a trial deposition. And when the first appendix was put together, the trial discovery deposition was put in where the trial deposition should have been. So the references in my reply brief and answering brief, the defendant's appeal, do not match the appendix that was sent in, but they do in the corrected appendix.
Thank you. The clerk's office has told us
that was filed. I found that out last night when I was getting ready. With regard to the appellant's appeal, I believe that the error made by the court below in allowing the defendant to not only cross-examine the plaintiff concerning her settlement of a previous accident, but to also use the release of that accident, and then to argue to the jury that the settlement and release was evidence of the fact that she had already been compensated for her injuries, and they shouldn't compensate her anymore, is in direct contravention to this court's decision in Alexander versus Cahill. And I think it is almost beyond comment that the error of the court in allowing that testimony concerning the settlement and the release, and then permitting defense counsel to argue that the plaintiff had already been compensated, is just clear error and does not really take much explanation.
We don't have any explanation from the trial court as to the rationale for admission, just that it's admissible.
She just said, I presume as I reread the transcript that the general rule is that where there are two defendants, that you have to tell the jury about the settlement because there might be apportionment in lacrosse claims. And the court may have been focusing on that type of law. But in this case, there were no cross claims. There was no request for apportionment. The settlement, which I negotiated, is shown by the stipulation dismissal at A16 of my appendix. It specifically said in the stipulation dismissal for the first claim that all cross claims were being dismissed. So there was no need to explain to the jury why the first accident defendant was not there, because they would not have to apportion anything.
Is this happening a lot now, this joining two completely unrelated accidents in a single complaint? It struck me as unusual.
Well, if I had not done that when I filed the case, if I tried first accident on let's say, week one, that plaintiff would have been pointing to the defendant and saying everything, the second defendant saying, our accident didn't cause it, the second accident caused it. And then when I tried the second case a week later, the defendant in that case, we'd be pointing to the first case and say, no, my accident didn't cause it, the first accident caused it. So you sort of have to combine them. Once we got into the medical evidence, and Your Honor will have to recall this case was originally filed as an arbitration case before Ms. Wright had any of her surgeries. So it was not thought of as a very significant accident. It was not until the effects of the second accident became known that she had the two surgical effusions, which made it a much more severe case, given the fact that the evidence showed that she had $125,000 in post-PIP medical expenses. So, I mean, that's why it had to be combined. But I think the rationale of Alexander versus Cahill and even the court's most recent case in Sammons versus Doctors for Emergency Service make clear that the only reason that you bring up the settlement is to explain to the jury why defendant number one is not there when the jury is still going to have to apportion any judgment in favor of the plaintiff between those two defendants.
So the timing of the settlement itself preceded the opening statements.
A week or two. And the defendant knew about it. I mean, because we explained in the arguments on Dr. Bose's deposition testimony, it was explained that there was going to be that the case had been settled. I told the court, so it was an open court. The defendant's attorney was there. The judge knew it. So there was no confusion about that. Nor was there any.
Was there anything during the course of a deposition or in any document that the jury saw that had the other defendant identified?
Of course, during the depositions, it was the testimony about the first accident and the second accident, and that's a point of dispute with Dr. Bose's testimony. But as far as I know, nothing the jury was given said that there was a first lawsuit.
Okay.
Well, I thought that during the examination of your client, there was reference to the complaint and the allegations of the complaint that, you know, it was a single injury caused by both of them. So
that was after, if you're going to recall, during plaintiff or defendant's opening statement, just before he got to the settlement. I interrupted his opening, which is something I don't usually do, and I raised the objection, Your Honor, he can't mention settlement. Rule 408 prohibits it. And she said, no, this is fair game. You know, of course he has to mention it. So at that point, you know, I had no basis for objecting. Although, you know, there are, as I pointed out in my brief, he went beyond what the judge allowed him to do. I think when he brought in the release and then argued to the jury, you shouldn't award her more money because she's already been compensated. That's precisely what this court said in KL was inappropriate and improper.
Well, let's assume hypothetically there was another trial. You know, you win. There's a remand for a new trial. Is it your position that they could refer to the allegations in the complaint or not?
I don't think they could, Your Honor. I think they could. It's fair game, as I said in my brief, for them to use all the medical evidence and make a strong argument, which I think they did, that the first accident caused most of it. That's fair game, and I have no problem with that. But to try and bring in, the only purpose of bringing in that first accident and the first claim was to try to convince the jury that she had already been compensated. There was no other purpose for that. The defendant does allude in his briefs that, well, we had to distinguish between Bose's deposition testimony and trial testimony. If you recall, I mentioned in my briefs that in his opening statement, the defendant made the statement that Dr. Bose had changed his testimony because of the release.
Well, the record's pretty clear that that was inaccurate.
Right. But then in his closing, he went back and made reference to it again in his closing arguments. So, I mean, there's no basis for bringing up the settlement in this case. Alexander and Cahill say, one, the only purpose is to avoid confusion. But there was no confusion here. The only confusion was because the plaintiff or defendant tried to create the confusion. If I can turn to the second argument I have on appeal, the negligence per se argument, I think the court below was in clear error again in not giving the requested instruction negligence per se. There, the defendant admitted that he could not see the defendant plaintiff's vehicle. He admitted he only used his right-hand mirror rather than his left-hand mirror when backing up. He pled guilty to inattentive driving and admitted that he would not plead guilty if he didn't realize he was violating the statute. In one respect, the defendant and I agree. The defendant's appeal in this case says that the court was wrong in just reading the statutes to the jury. I would agree, because that's just leaving, you know, the jury would have absolutely no idea why the statute was read to them. That's why the negligence per se instruction is appropriate. It's a standard instruction. I have never heard of a judge in an automobile injury case refusing to give negligence per se instruction when the defendant has pled guilty to the statute.
Well, this trial judge apparently said she never gives it.
That was my first trial with that judge, and I was, you know, I hesitate to say shocked, but surprised to hear a judge say that, because it's so routine, it's almost to be without question. It's a standard jury instruction, and if this case fits, why negligent per se instruction should be given?
Help me out on this one. If there's negligence per se, then doesn't liability have to be conceded?
No, because you still have to prove proximate cause. Negligence would be...
Right. Is that an issue in this case?
Well, apparently the jury found that there was no negligence in this case. The interrogatory was, did the defendant's negligence proximately cause the injury? And they answered no.
And was there testimony to explain the guilty plea, like, well, I really didn't mean to plead
He did guilty. Testify, and I guess it's permissible, he did testify that he was too busy to come down. He was a driver from Pennsylvania, so I just didn't want to take the time to come down and fight it. But he admitted in his deposition he would not have done that if he didn't believe he had violated the statute. So that calls that testimony in question. Yeah.
Well, I'm still trying to parse this out. If you have an accident and one of the drivers was looking down, getting a cup of coffee off of the console when he hit the first driver, and he pleads guilty to inattentive driving. Is there, assuming that a negligence per se instruction is given, what is left of that case in liability?
The jury would have to decide, did his negligence proximately cause the injury?
So in your case, they would be focusing on the other accident.
they would be focusing on which accident caused the injuries, which is a legitimate point of departure here. But they were, I think they were denied that because of the failure to give the negligence per se. So we don't, you know, we don't really know whether it was the negligence they focused on or the proximate cause argument. But I think the proximate cause argument is defeated because was defeated in this case because of the strong arguments that she had already been compensated in the first accident.
Well, were there interrogatories presented to the jury to parse it out as to whether they find there was negligence but no proximate cause, or they find there was no negligence and therefore they don't reach proximate cause?
I don't know. I'd have to go back and take a look here. I do not recall exactly whether those were separate interrogatories or not. It wasn't an argument brought up in the briefing, I don't think.
It was, a single interrogatory. Do you find negligence that proximately caused?
That's generally what is done in these cases. If I could take a couple of minutes and turn to the appellant's argument, which I'll deal with more on my rebuttal. I think the appellee's argument, on the cross appeal is whether or not Dr. Bowe should have been allowed to testify. And as I point out in my answering brief to his appeal and in my reply brief, here you have a treating physician who took a self-reported history from the plaintiff, had reviewed all of her medical records before his discovery deposition, relied on his clinical treatment, his exams, the clinical tests, the MRIs, the CAT scans, and myelograms, and he made a differential diagnosis. He said that more of her injuries came from the second accident than the first accident. And if you look at the facts in this case, it also is important. Before the second accident, she had had no invasive medical treatment. She had had one course of physical therapy, four visits to a doctor, Dr. Hogan. Dr. Hogan made no diagnosis of a neck injury. He did take one flat X-ray of her neck during one of the treatments. But you know, he said in testimony, he made no mention of it. There was no diagnosis by any doctor that she had a neck injury. The only reference to neck injuries were in the physical therapist report. She has a second injury. She immediately goes to the hospital, gets an injection for neck pain, and then is referred to an orthopedic surgeon and then to a neurosurgeon, where she ends up having two neck fusions. And Dr. Bowe said, you know, based upon the lack of treatment before the second accident and the vast amount of treatment after the second accident and the minimal complaints from the second accident, he could not give an exact percentage, 10% from the first or 20%. But he said most of it was from the second accident. And this is how many times do we try cases in the Superior Court for motor vehicle accidents where somebody has a pre-existing problem and is aggravated by the accident in question? Juries are called upon time and time again to make that distinction between trying to differentiate what complaints they had before the accident, what complaints they had after the accident. That's routine. And I don't think any court has held that a physician attributing most of the injuries to the second accident must say with exactitude of percentages what percentage preexisted the accident, what percentage was caused by the accident in question. I think and there can be no question under a Daubert analysis, he was a qualified expert. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Dorler.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm here today on behalf of the defendants. As the court's aware, there's both a direct appeal and a cross appeal, and you don't need to reach the issues in the cross appeal, in my opinion, until you decide that the plaintiff's appeal has some merit. So I'll start off by addressing the plaintiff's issues from the plaintiff's appeal. The first issue relates to the issue of the settlement itself and whether that was properly admissible. The plaintiff admits that this type of evidence is admissible to eliminate jury confusion. Plaintiff, however, attempts to pigeonhole the confusion that a jury can have to situations where there are joint tortfeasors. In response to your earlier question, Your Honor, it is an increasing habit that I've seen that people are being sued for unrelated lawsuits within the same lawsuit. Maybe that's economies of scale. They can bring their doctor in once. But it is not unusual to have two unrelated accidents addressed in the same lawsuit. So this potentially could be an issue that, that would arise again. There was, you know, and in this case, also, there was questioning about the accident, the both of the accidents, to the plaintiff, and that was proper questioning. She had filed a complaint.
But did this jury know through, until you brought it, your side brought it up, did the jury know about the other accident being part of the very lawsuit they were trying?
Well, if your question refers to whether there are documents, such as the complaint in the record, no, there weren't. The plaintiff was properly questioned about the facts of the first accident during her direct examination. The allegations in the complaint were that both accidents caused her the very same injuries to the very same parts of her body. Those are judicial admissions about which she can certainly be questioned on a trial. And so in response to Your Honor's question, she can be questioned on those things if this case goes back.
Well, let's see. In many cases, you might have two accidents where you hurt your elbow in both accidents, but you think that the second accident enhanced the injury. In that situation, hypothetically, why do they need to know that after the first accident you settled? And why don't they just need to know the nature of the injury in the first accident and then look at the second accident to see if there was any enhancement?
The confusion arises, Your Honor, with respect to the fact that the second accident is only related to the aggravation. People are going to see one injury and not understand the distinction between the first accident and the second accident, and the fact that you can only hold the defendant from the second accident liable for the injuries caused in that accident.
But as Mr. Aver said, that's a fairly routine exercise when people are in car accidents. You either have a prior injury at work or you injured yourself at home, but many people have prior or pre-existing injuries, and the argument always is, the second person is only liable for the enhancement. Why does the jury need to know about the settlement?
The jury needs to know, Your Honor, in order to avoid the confusion. They need to know in this particular case, I don't want to speak in a vacuum. In this particular case, she made the very same allegations in this complaint that both injuries were caused by all of her injuries were caused by both accidents. I think to take it to separate lawsuits, I don't think that's fair in this particular case. In this case, she made the allegations in her complaint that both people caused her the very same injuries. Now, one of those people who she sued in her complaint in this very lawsuit is no longer before the court. And they do need an explanation as to why that person is not there. They are confused. Here's two people sued, one of them's gone, why is that? And I think that's where the confusion comes up.
But they didn't know that here's two people sued.
They did, Your Honor, because of the questioning at trial. Didn't you file a complaint in this action alleging that you were in two different accidents and that they both caused you these injuries?
Who's questioning?
The defense counsel's questioning. In order to impeach her claims that the second accident was causing her injuries.
Well, why does it have to be structured in a way that elicits the settlement? The fact that there was an accident?
I think it does, Your Honor, because the question is going to be in their mind, has she been compensated for those other injuries? I think that there's a risk that they're going to view it as one injury. And I think in order to clarify that they are separate injuries, that they shouldn't consider the amount of what
she died. Isn't the jury told when they're instructed on aggravation of pre-existing injury that they can only award damages for the aggravation and not the pre-existing injury?
They are, Your Honor.
So then what's the problem?
The problem is that we still have the second defendant and what happened to them.
But we don't have to worry about them compensating for the first injury because the jury's told they cannot do that.
They are told that, Your Honor, and whether that's sufficient is certainly a determination for Your Honor. It's our position that, you know, those instructions are given at the end of the case, and, you know, if they're informed about that during the case, it's instructed for them as well to avoid, as they're going and hearing the evidence, they're hearing that there's two people, and yet there's only one defendant present in the court. So throughout the case, they're wondering what happened to that defendant. So I don't think it's improper for them to be informed of the fact that there was a defendant, that defendant has settled. And it's also a proper argument that this plaintiff filed a lawsuit alleging that the very same injuries were caused by both people. And it's a fair argument that, in fact, all of her injuries were caused by the first one. And that, you know, because of that, you don't need to worry about, and she has been compensated for those, and so you don't need to, feel guilty or whatever, have sympathy and award him additional money for injuries that weren't caused by his accident. I think there's a real danger that people are going to, or that the jury will award compensation for the injuries from the first accident if they don't fully understand that that's really not an issue.
Are you suggesting that Alexander versus Cahill should be overruled?
I'm suggesting that it's not applicable in this case, Your Honor. The premise, and maybe I need to focus on that at this point, is that the Delaware Rule of Evidence 408, on which Alexander is premised, is not applicable to this situation. Delaware Rule 408 prevents settlements of this from the same accident. If you read that rule, it says that the evidence of accepting consideration of compromise of a claim, which is disputed, is not admissible to prove liability or the invalidity of the claim. It's referring to the one and the same claim. It's not saying you cannot use this settlement in another situation related to different liability.
Well, aren't you trying to have it both ways? Because you're arguing that since the complaint alleged that the same injuries were caused by both accidents, it's appropriate for you to bring to the jury's attention the fact that there was a separate claim and a separate recovery. But now, in terms of Alexander v. Cahill and the rule, you're saying, oh, but see, that only applies if it's the same claim. Well, shouldn't it be parallel? So if you're viewing this as being one claim because the same injuries were caused by both accidents, then the rule against using settlements should apply, shouldn't it?
I'm not sure I understand your question, Your Honor. The Delaware Rule 408 applies to the settlement with Mrs. Green, not Mr. Moore. And it says that in with respect to the injuries caused by Mrs. Green, you can't use the settlement to establish that somebody else is responsible for those injuries. It doesn't say that you can't use the settlement against Mrs. Green to establish that Mr. Moore, the Green settlement and arguments related to liability for injuries caused by Mrs. Green, that's when Rule 408 applies. And I don't think it's saying both ways. I think that I'm saying that Rule 408 isn't applicable because it limits liability and allegations in the context, say, for instance, of a joint tortfeasor, where one joint tortfeasor says, it's not me, it's the other joint tortfeasor, related to the same injuries, the injuries caused by Mrs. Green.
Well, you're trying to narrow our focus to the facts of your case, which is understandable. But the argument you're making sounds almost like you should have gotten relief as a matter of law. If we compare it to a contract where two people sign a note that they owe $100 and one person pays the $100, you would make a motion to dismiss the lawsuit against the other person on the basis that they've already been paid. And the way you're structuring your argument, this complaint was against two people for the same injury. You settle with one. You seem to be suggesting that there was nothing for the jury or anyone else to do because there had been complete payment.
If you accept the argument that her injuries were all caused by the first accident.
Well, no. If your argument is that the allegation in the complaint was all of her injuries were caused by both accidents, And when you settle for one, you've settled for all. End of inquiry. And Mr. Aver's saying, no, what the jury should see is if you had separate injuries in the second accident, and what amount of money do we attribute to the enhancement caused by the injuries in the second accident?
I think that there's alternative arguments being made here. The plaintiff initially said that both people caused her injuries, and that was what she was asked about. Now you're saying that you're saying that Mr. Moore has caused more of your injuries, and it's, you know, and we are certainly able to argue that based upon the evidence, we didn't cause any of your injuries, because, you know, for one reason, we weren't liable in this case, and because we weren't liable, which is one of the arguments that were made, we aren't responsible for any of your injuries.
And let's assume that that is 100% permissible. Why do you need to talk about the settlement in addition to what you just said? Why can't you just say, isn't it true that you said two people caused it, and now you're saying that we caused more injuries? Isn't that inconsistent with your complaint, and isn't it true that you really can't differentiate? Why is the settlement important?
The settlement, well, if you're not buying the confusion argument, it's in this case it's important for the secondary reason that it helps to explain the changes in Dr. Bose's testimony.
Well, yeah. But I think Mr. Aver takes the position Dr. Bose didn't change his testimony. He might have been a little more emphatic and elaborated it, but Mr. Aver's brief argues that he originally said the second accident caused more injuries. He just was a little more enthusiastic the second time.
Well, even if that's the case, the enthusiasm can be explained. And one of the reasons to explain the new enthusiasm is that she has now settled against defendant Green. So now, before, when all you're able to say is, it was both of them and I can't tell you much more, as soon as she settles, he's now able to say, well, hey, it's more defendant Moore. Initially in this case, and this goes really more to the cross appeal, but Dr. Bose, when he gave his first opinion back in October, I think it was 2003, he hadn't reviewed any medical records. He formed this opinion without eliminating any, you know, without even considering the prior accident.
Well, he had the history from the patient, didn't he?
He had a self-reported history from the patient for an internal injury, which is inadequate in light of the fact that there are two accidents here. He's not performing solely a differential diagnosis. He said, when I was treating her, when I issued that opinion, I was simply treating her. I was not attempting to give a causation opinion. You don't need to give a causation opinion to give a differential diagnosis. You can say she's suffering from X, and yes, she may be suffering from X, but that doesn't tell you what the cause of X is. And in addition, the differential diagnosis is inadequate because a differential diagnosis requires both ruling in and ruling out causes of an accident, causes of an injury. So he didn't even do that in this case. When he formed his opinion, regardless, and he says in there, regardless of what the record said from before the first accident, I would have concluded that both accidents caused this accident. That is an opinion based upon faith, not upon science. Based upon faith, because no matter what you say, it can't be changed. Regardless of what science showed him, he would have reached this conclusion. He may have reviewed the records after the fact to buttress that, but that is not a definitive scientific process. The case law says, moreover, that definitive diagnoses are subjected to Daubert analysis. Plaintiff's argument is that just because he says it's a differential diagnosis, that's sufficient for Daubert analysis. I don't think any case law in the state of Delaware precludes differential diagnoses from a Daubert analysis. The differential diagnosis still has to be reached and determined in a reliable manner, and that did not occur in this case. The fundamental flaw in his opinion and the court erred when it let his opinion in. The with respect to the arguments made by defense counsel that were raised in plaintiff's brief, the argument is that there was an error made in the opening statement about when Dr. Bose first made these opinions. It's our position that plaintiff had ample opportunity to correct that, even if the court didn't allow him. He could have corrected that during the trial itself. Just because a statement was made in error in the beginning doesn't mean that, you know, he can't question his expert on that and get that straightened out. Regardless, it's our position that he waived that issue, the plaintiff waived that issue, because the court said, okay, well, you can go ahead and correct this error by talking to Dr. Bose and establishing when he first reached these opinions. But although the court granted, and he said that would be, and plaintiff's counsel said, okay, that's great, that will cure the prejudice possibly caused by this. And yet, despite being granted permission to talk to Dr. Bose about his when he first reached his opinions, the plaintiff chose not to take the cure that plaintiff's counsel said would be sufficient. So it's our position that arguments with respect to that particular issue have been waived.
I wanted to ask you a question regarding the application of the motor vehicle statutes to private property to see if you still wish to press at least one of the arguments, and that's relating to 4176 A and B. Is it still your contention that those statutes do not apply on private property?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that the opening,
let me direct your attention to Section 4101, which says, under subparagraph A2, that subchapter 9 of this chapter shall apply upon highways and elsewhere throughout the state. And subchapter 9 contains sections 4175 through 4177M. So we have a legislative direction that it applies elsewhere throughout the state. Doesn't that mean private property?
Your Honor, it may. I think that you can take it. I don't think it's intended to be read as broadly as you're saying here. And I think we have the Kearns case, which says that it's not shouldn't apply on private property. The rules of the road. These are the rules of the road. They shouldn't apply on private property. To the extent that they apply on private property, the question then becomes, Your Honor, whether these rules of the road are negligence per se on private property, or whether they should in fact be treated as evidence of negligence, or evidence of something that a reasonable person would have followed.
Well, in other cases, aren't Superior Court judges routinely giving instructions that a violation of 4176 A or B constitutes negligence per se? And
Your Honor, I can't speak to what other judges are doing routinely.
That hasn't happened in your experience in other cases?
No, Your Honor. I can't say that this is the first time I've been in an auto accident in court. A lot of the cases settle. Maybe this is the first auto accident case. But it is an instruction, and it is there. I think that what's missing from the plaintiff's analysis is any consideration of Joseph, which controls in this instance. There's other cases like Hand and Norfleet. Those cases clearly say that in order for a statute to be negligence per se, in addition to being enacted for the safety of others, there has to be a specific standard rather than a general rule of conduct. Okay? Referring to things generally as safely, that's just a general rule of conduct. And I think that, you know, this court clearly said in Joseph that that's what was required in order for negligence per se. So regardless of the fact that courts may be instructing based upon those instructions, I don't believe that they are being consistent with Joseph.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
try and respond quickly to what the defendant said. The issue of confusion is not in this case. I think that's demonstrated, as I said, by the closing argument of defense counsel. They didn't try to explain any confusion why the defendant wasn't there. The only argument they made was she's already been compensated and you shouldn't award her more money. Alexander forbids that type of purpose of bringing up settlement. The issue of the fact that the complaint was brought in, as Your Honor brought up, the plaintiff never brought up the fact that the complaint had two accidents. And that was something injected by the defendant. So if there was confusion that had to be explained because of the complaint, because the defendant first confused the jury and now is trying to use post hoc reasoning to say, well, now that I've confused you, let me explain what the way the confusion by bringing in the settlement. So if there was a need for the settlement to avoid the confusion, it was only because the defendant injected the confusion into the case. And I don't think they can use that type of tactic to try and get around Rule 408. As Your Honor also pointed out, the standard instruction that was given in this case, the jury was instructed on the aggravation of a pre-existing condition. So this case is no different than any other case where a plaintiff has an injured back at one point in time, and at a later point in time they re-injure that back, and the jury is going to hear all the testimony, and it was vigorously presented in this case. The defendant did a good job in presenting the evidence from the first act, medical evidence from the first accident. The juries are called upon time and time again to try and separate out the medical evidence from the first injury from the medical evidence from the second injury. That's what they were called upon to do in this case by the aggravation instruction. The fact that there is confusion, I just don't think applies in this case. Regarding Dr. Bose's testimony, the defendant's counsel said that I could have corrected that at trial, and I could have asked Dr. Bose to explain his testimony. The problem was Dr. Bose had testified a week before trial. As is now becoming the general custom, at least in Newcastle County, the doctors don't come to court. They all want depositions done in their offices. And they won't come to court, and so we accommodate them. We take the depositions in their office. There is no way, once the plaintiff defendant made the argument in his opening statement, that Dr. Bose changed his testimony by his trial deposition, that I could have called Dr. Bose in to explain that. That's why I did something that I had never done before in my life. Filed a motion for a protective order during the jury conference trial where the defendant said, I won't do that again. And in his closing argument, he did it again. And I objected, and the court overruled my objection. I would, with all due respect, Your Honor, have to sort of differentiate. I don't believe Dr. Bose spoke with greater enthusiasm in his trial deposition than the first one. The last thing he was asked in his discovery deposition was what actually was. He said, the second more than the first. And that's exactly what he said in the trial deposition. It wasn't any more. What I did in the trial deposition, I went through all the treatment, and after I went through the treatment, I asked him, do you have an opinion as to which accident caused her accident, her injury, her problems? And in fact, in my closing argument, I didn't ask his opinion for all of her complaints, pain and suffering. The questions were pointed. Do you believe that she would have needed surgery but for the second accident? He said no. I think before that, I think I asked him first in order was, is most of her pain today related to a surgery? He said yes. And he says, would she have needed the surgery but for the second accident? He said no. But his testimony in the trial deposition was that most of the problems came from the first accident, not the second. And this is the point that this is a differential diagnosis. This is clearly what the cases say, and I again refer your honors to I probably mispronounced it, the Canakill decision of the Third Circuit, where the court said in that case, the fact that the doctor can use a differential diagnosis for causation, which the defendant disputed, and then the court went and says, you need not be the best testimony possible, it just has to be reliable and relevant. And reliable was relying on everything that Dr. Bose relied upon, self-reported history, a review of all the medical records, his own treatment, all the medical tests, the MRIs, the CAT scans, the myelograms that he did, and the surgeries he did. That's what Canakill says. As long as it's relevant and reliable, which that shows it is, then he can use a differential diagnosis, differentiate between different causes. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement, and we will take a recess.